book genres are so 20th century. No, 19th century. They made sense when each book needed to be placed on a physical shelf so people could find similar titles. But what if you want to find a vampire romance, a post-apocalyptic comedy, a Western mystery where the main character is an android, a World War II adventure with magic, or a story based around a character of any race or religion or gender, set in any time or any place you choose? Scribble now brings searching for books into the 21st century, even if you're looking for one set in the 17th. Find the books you'll love by selecting the story elements that matter to you at scribble.com. You'll never look for books the same way again. Search by story elements, only at scribble.com. That's scribble.com.
This is episode 1 of Autumn Leaves, a Paul Kingston mystery, written and read by Stephen L. Moss. Chapter 1. I was sitting on the front porch when the phone rang, watching a passing airliner scar the October sky. Its leading edge was thin, razor sharp. Farther back, the smoke spread and faded. I thought of how wounds begin that way, defined, angry. Then, like a trail of smoke, they blur and fade. Yet they are always there, irregular, imperfect, reminding us of the wounds we've endured. The phone chirped again, playing the opening notes of Steely Dan's Hey 19, yanking my eyes to the table in front of me. I reached for the phone and glanced at its screen. The number was local, but I didn't recognize it. "Hello," I said. "Hey, Paul, it's Dante Hillman. How you doing?" "Dante." For a moment I didn't recognize the name or the voice that had spoken it. "Come on, man. Don't tell me you forgot who I am already." "No," I said, my head finally supplying the face that went with the name. "Of course not. Dante, how's it going?"
"All is well."
"Listen, Paul, I hear Clive Peterson's in town."
"Oh?"
Clive Peterson was a jazz trumpeter, best known for his run with a late-night talk show band in the 80s. More recently, he had divided his time between Hollywood session work and European tours. Born and raised here in Milwaukee, he had moved back home and was spending more time here as he got along in years and his touring schedule slowed down.
"Yeah, and I was thinking about how you promised to introduce me to him."
"Right," I said. I had been in a tight spot this past April, accused of murdering an old friend and bandmate. Desperate for information I'd been told Dante might have, I had promised to introduce him to Clive. Dante was a trumpet player himself, or so he had claimed.
"Oh, now don't tell me you forgot. Damn. You do a guy a favor and what does he do? Forgets who you are and what he promised."
"No, Dante, I remember."
"Then what about it?"
"Look," I said, "I haven't heard you play. I can't recommend you to Clive if I don't know what kind of chops you have. Maybe we could get together and jam a little first."
"Oh, now listen to this," Dante said, his voice indignant. "Now I gotta prove myself to the gatekeeper? Bullshit. That's not what you told me when you needed my help."
I thought back to the first time I had met Dante, in a little dive of a bar near the waterfront, which he used as a base of operations for his main occupation, which was selling marijuana and perhaps other illicit products or services I didn't know about. The information he had given me, the fact that Billy Reno, the old friend of mine who'd turned up dead, had sometimes delivered Dante's merchandise from his anonymous supplier, hadn't really been much help. But a promise was a promise.
"Okay," I said. "I'll call him." "That's more like it," Dante said. "Let me know how it goes." "My name is Paul Kingston. I'm 43 years old. I make my living playing bass guitar. Any style you want. I'm not picky. Milwaukee's been my home most of my life, except for some time away for college and a few times when I've gone on tour. I'm divorced, no kids, no siblings, and both of my parents died young. I live in the Bayview section of town, a small chunk of the near south side that stretches from Lake Michigan on the east to Howell Avenue on the west, give or take a few blocks. My home is paid for, an inheritance from a favorite aunt, and that comes in handy since my income is variable. Sometimes the living is easy, other times it's not, but I've always gotten by, and I've never had to get a real job. I hadn't heard that Clive was in town, but we didn't work together all that often. Clive had a core group of players, the Clive Peterson Quartet, that he'd kept together for at least 15 years. Occasionally I would sub for their bassist, Smokey Mitchell. When I did, Clive would generally rag on me for playing my electric bass instead of an upright like Smokey played. I own an upright, but I haven't taken the time to learn to play it. For jazz gigs, I get by on my fretless bass. Clive has called me in quite a few times over the years, so I guess I'm a tolerable substitute. I wasn't sure I had enough clout with Clive to introduce him to a trumpet player I'd never heard. I regretted making that promise, but I'd been in a rough situation then, and I'd done what I had to. The worst that could happen was that Clive would say no and I'd look like a jerk. Either that, or Clive would say yes and Dante would turn out to be a shitty trumpet player, and I'd look like a jerk who wasn't going to get any more sub-calls from Clive Peterson anymore. I picked up my phone and was about to search its memory for Clive's number when it started playing Hey 19 again. "Hello?" "Paul, my man," said a deep and smiling voice. "It's Clive Peterson." I felt an eerie shiver run up my spine at the coincidence. "Hello, Clive." "You okay, man? You sound a little shaky." "It's nothing. I'm good. What can I do for you?" "Listen, man, I need a favor. Smokey's in the hospital. Old bastard had himself a heart attack." "Oh, man, is he all right?" "They say he will be. He's going to need a bypass. He'll be out of commission for a while. But he should be good as new when it's all over." "That's good to hear." "Thing is, we've got 6 nights booked at my club starting tonight, and I need a bass. I know it's short notice. Can you fill in?" Clive had opened his own club on the north side about a year before, appropriately named Clive's. His son Charles ran it for him, or so I'd heard. I hadn't had the chance to stop by or play there so far. "Not a problem," I said. "I'm free for the next 4 nights. I might be able to make arrangements for the other two." This was a lie, actually. Today was a Sunday. With the exception of a lunchtime gig on Thursday, my schedule was blank until the next Saturday, when I had a wedding reception out in Brookfield. But I preferred not to admit that I had quite as much free time as I had. "That's great. I don't suppose you got yourself a real bass yet, have you?" I heard him chuckle. "No, same old toy. Still want me?" "We'll make do." "May I ask a favor in return?"
"You may."
I told him about Dante. I admitted that I hadn't heard him, but that I had promised I would ask about him.
"What does he do for a living?"
I knew Clive had very negative feelings toward drugs. This could be an issue. Why? I asked.
"Just wondering if he has to work in the morning."
"Oh," I said, trying to hide my relief. "I think he has a flexible schedule. He's in sales." I hoped he wouldn't ask me any more. Mercifully, he didn't.
"Sure," Clive said. "Tell him he can sit in on the late set tonight. If he's a stinker, at least the prime time folks won't hear him."
We talked a little more, settling on payment. I thanked him and we hung up. I was grateful to be able to come to Clive's aid. It made it easier to bring up Dante. Plus, now I would be there to see for myself whether Dante could play or not. It was my lucky day.
Or so it seemed. Chapter 2. I had a couple of hours before I'd need to head up to the club. I pulled my fretless bass out of its case and tuned it. I plugged it in and ran a few scales, both to make sure the pickups were sounding clean and to get used to playing this guitar again. I wondered when I'd played it last. Late afternoon sunshine bathed my kitchen in light. The temperature was still in the mid-60s, but my open windows carried a hint of chill from Lake Michigan, 2 blocks east of me. I made a grilled cheese sandwich and opened a yogurt cup and went back out to the front porch to eat. I live on the second floor of a duplex. My narrow front porch spans its front face, built over a corresponding front entryway on the lower floor. Above me, the airplane's contrail had faded, and the sky was a brilliant blue once again. On Wentworth Street in front of me, the reds and oranges of the turning leaves danced in the breeze. The sun had disappeared behind the back side of my house, leaving my porch shady but bathing the trees in light. I smelled the dry, crisp autumn air and listened to the sounds of children playing in the street below. It was good to sit out here, and there wouldn't be many more days as nice as this before another cold Milwaukee winter set in. It would be nice to sit out here all evening. But duty called. The coming work week had been looking a little sparse. It would be fine with me to have an unexpected wad of cash in my pocket after a few nights at Clive's. Repast finished, I cleared the dishes and changed into a jacket and tie. Jazz players dress better than my standard uniform of jeans and Hawaiian shirt. I'm not a big fan of neckties, but when in Rome... I lugged my bass and amp down the stairs and loaded them in my car, a beige Honda Civic, whose myriad scratches and dents told a sad tale of urban life. Like my house, the car was paid for, and that was a most positive quality, in my opinion. Clive's was on North Avenue, just east of the Sherman Park area, in a neighborhood of shabby duplexes and bare dirt lawns. Among the currency exchanges and corner stores with barred front windows, there were signs of gentrification. Clive's itself was a large storefront tavern, freshly painted black with a royal blue awning over the front door. A matching blue neon light spelling Clive's shone in a front window. Across the street was a low cream brick building with a hand-lettered sign over its front door that said, North Avenue Neighborhood Center. All are welcome. A basketball court and a small playground stood next to it, behind a new chain-link fence. A boisterous group of young men played basketball, while a group of younger kids enjoyed the playground. I parked on North and stepped into Clive's, its interior dim compared to the bright sun outside. I waited a moment for my eyes to adjust. I saw a man approach me and recognized Clive's son, Charles. He was about 5 feet 8 inches tall, with mocha-colored skin and salt-and-pepper hair. A baggy shirt and slacks hung on his pudgy frame, and his face bore the sallow expression of a man who spends too much time worrying and not enough sleeping. "Paul," he said, with a smile that looked pained. The hand that shook mine was limp. We exchanged pleasantries, and he led me to a group of 3 other men who were gathered around a high table near the bar. "This is Sam. He works for us, cleaning, stocking, and handling deliveries." Sam was wet-eyed and tired-looking. He seemed ill at ease standing around, as if he needed to be working to prove he really existed. "This is Troy Jackson, Clive's new manager," Charles said, gesturing to a darker man with a shaved head and a sharp-eyed expression. I recalled that Clive had let go of his longtime manager, Arnold Lepke, amidst rumors that Lepke had been accused of skimming money from the band. "And this is Stan Dombrowski," Charles continued. pointing to a tall, slim, white man with large brown eyes and a kind expression. Stan runs the rec center across the street, and he helps out around here when we need an extra pair of hands. We all shook. Sam trudged away without a word. Troy appraised me silently. Stan held my handshake with a warm smile. "Paul Kingston, it's a pleasure to meet you. I'm a big Josie Comes Home fan," he said, referring to one of the bands I play with, a Steely Dan tribute band. "A pleasure," I said. I turned to Troy and asked after Smokey. "He's stable. They're running some tests to make sure he's strong enough for the bypass surgery. We're not sure when he'll be back. Thanks for helping us out." He delivered this in a flat monotone as if by rote. He had the air of someone who would rather be doing something else with his life. I wondered how much he appreciated the job of band manager. I excused myself and headed to the stage. As I lugged my amp up the three steps on the platform's left side, the rest of Clive's band ambled out from backstage. Israel Thomas, Izzy to most who knew him, was 5'10" and wiry. His steel-gray hair was combed back so that it curled slightly around his ears. His eyes were bleary, bloodshot, the eyes of a lifelong drinker. He walked gingerly, as if he feared he would bump into some invisible object. Behind him was Jeremiah McGee, the piano player. Taller and stockier than Izzy, his hair was a mane of dreadlocks streaked with silver, with a wispy goatee to match. His face was set in a brooding expression. I set my bass on stage next to my amp and climbed up to greet them. Izzy smiled and said hello, swaying as if the act of greeting me might knock him off balance. His breath carried no hint of alcohol, but his body seemed to have adapted to a state of permanent drunkenness. Jeremiah nodded silently, his angry eyes boring into mine, and then glaring at the fretless bass on my shoulder. Then he turned away, muttering something about that jazz fusion shit. After they'd set up, Izzy and Jeremiah climbed off stage and headed toward the bar, where Troy and Stan were talking. Charles stood behind it, slicing limes. I busied myself with plugging in and tuning. I could hear the sound of a trumpet warming up backstage. The trumpet playing ceased a few minutes later, and then I heard heavy footsteps approaching. "Paul, my man," said a voice behind me. I turned around. "Hey, Clive," I said. We shook hands. Clive Peterson was 6'3" and heavy-set, with close-cropped hair. Where Jeremiah's face was dark and brooding, Clive's was jovial, open, often smiling. Seeing him often made me think of a laughing Buddha. "I see you brought your toothpick," he said, pointing at my fretless bass. "Only the best for you, Mr. Peterson," I said, giving him a mock bow. He laughed. Noticing Clive on stage, Jeremiah and Izzy returned, and Troy moved to a mixing board on the opposite wall. I caught Jeremiah throwing a hateful stare in Clive's direction. Trouble in paradise? We warmed up while Troy ran a sound check. At one point the screech of a microphone feeding back pierced the air and then disappeared as Troy worked sliders on the board. "Watch yourself, boy," Clive said into his own mic. There was a malicious edge in his voice that piqued my interest. We played a couple more numbers before Troy waved to say the mic levels were fine. Then, without a word, Clive set his trumpet on a stand and stepped off stage. Jeremiah and Izzy followed. I had a curious sense of unease. The quartet's playing seemed stilted, out of sync. Was it me, or rather the absence of Smokey, the band's regular bassist? Was Izzy nipping at a hidden bottle after all? I wondered if the next few nights were going to seem longer than I had expected. Turns out they did, but not for any reason I could have guessed in that moment. The first customers drifted in at about 6:30. I found my way backstage to stash the gig bag I carried my bass in. I found myself in a narrow hallway. A door at the end was marked with a lighted exit sign. To my left was an electrical box on the wall and a bank of switches for the stage lights. To my right were two doors. The first stood open and led the way to a green room, a lounge where the evening's players could rest before and between sets. The second door was closed. Out of curiosity, I went to it and pulled it open. A darkened stairway led down to a basement below. I closed it and went back to the first door. The green room was small but neat, with beat-up upholstered furniture, a couple of scarred end tables, and a floor lamp. Outdated copies of Downbeat magazine sat in a wire rack near one of the end tables. A couple of trumpet mutes stood on another end table. Someone's half-empty pack of Salems occupied another. I set my gig bag down next to one of the tables and returned to the stage. I could see the sky darkening outside. More customers had come in, a mixture of black and white faces, most of them middle-aged. The men dressed in suits and loosened ties, the women in conservative suits or dresses, as if they'd come from office jobs downtown. A few younger folks dotted the crowd, the white ones scruffy hipsters with moony expressions, the black ones harder to pin into one crowd. A Dave Brubeck album played over the PA system, and heads bobbed in time to the music. I ambled to the bar and took an empty stool between Stan and Jeremiah. Jeremiah nursed a rum and coke, leaning over the bar as if protecting his drink from prying eyes or would-be raiders. On his other side, Izzy sipped glumly at a plain soda water. I guessed he did his drinking outside of work, or at least pretended to. To my left, Stan sat with a glass of white wine. When Charles happened by, I ordered a Goose Island IPA. When he brought it, I inhaled its bitter aroma before taking a flavorful sip. Stan turned to me. "I'm sorry for the circumstances that brought you here, but I'm glad to have things mixed up a bit," he said. "Smokey's shoes are too big for me to fill," I answered. I thought I heard Jeremiah snort at this. I glanced at him. His eyes were on his drink, his face fixed in a fierce expression. I decided to leave him alone. "You're too modest," Stan said. "Plus, it's hard to sound bad when that gentleman is standing in front of you." He gestured toward Clive, who bantered with a couple sitting at a table near the stage, a cocktail glass in his hand. "No arguments there," I said. "So, you run the neighborhood center?" He smiled. "I try to, anyway. It's like herding cats sometimes, but I love it." "Charles mentioned that you help out at the club as well?" "I pitch in when I can. Mostly setting up and running the sound system when Troy's busy. I love jazz. Got that from my mother. She was born in Poland, barely spoke English, but she could tell you every tune Dizzy Gillespie ever recorded. She would have loved Clive." "She passed away?" He nodded. "She died when I was young." "I'm sorry," I said. "So am I, but she lived long enough to pass on her love of this music, and every time I hear it, I think of her." We drank in companionable silence after that. I watched more customers trickle into the club. The crowd wasn't large, but it wasn't bad for a Sunday evening. I finished my beer and thought about ordering another, but decided against it. Maybe later. Around 7:30, Jeremiah and Izzy rose from their stools. Looking over my shoulder, I saw Clive approaching the stage. I rose and followed. "Break a leg," Stan said, smiling. "Thanks," I said, and smiled in return. I trailed the rest of the band to the green room. Jeremiah grabbed a pack of cigarettes and headed down the hall, presumably to smoke one out in the alley. Izzy sank into a couch whose springs groaned despite his slight frame. Clive pulled me aside and ran through the numbers he expected to call out during the first set, and the keys we would play them in. I grabbed a spiral notebook and a pencil from my gig bag and jotted the numbers down. A few minutes later, Jeremiah returned in a haze of used tobacco smoke. Izzy pulled himself gingerly to his feet. Out in the club, the recorded music faded and stopped. Troy's voice came from the PA, introducing the Clive Peterson Quartet to a lively round of applause. Clive nodded, and Jeremiah, Izzy, and I filed onto the stage behind him. The house lights had dimmed, the crowd was hushed. Most of their faces had disappeared in the glare of the stage lights. Whispered conversations and stifled laughs accompanied us as we took our places on stage. It always sounds to the players like those laughs are aimed at us, but of course most of them are not. The folks in the audience were there to enjoy themselves, and that's what they were doing. I wiped my hands on a cloth I had left on my amp, and then stuffed it in my back pocket. I took a breath, settled myself, and watched Clive. A moment later, he counted us into a lively version of A Night in Tunisia, and all the unease that had dogged me since our uninspired soundcheck melted away. Thanks for listening to episode 1 of Autumn Leaves, a Paul Kingston mystery by Stephen L. Moss. Music is by Jewelbeat. This has been a presentation of Northside Press, offered under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivative Works 3.0 license. For more information, please visit StephenLMoss.com.